Then airlines after that, so we're civilians again.
You have brothers and sisters?
One brother, two sisters. Brother's also a geocacher, known as Lizard Man. He hasn't done much in a while. And there's actually two Lizard Men out there, and I think my brother's the one that's one word. They're both Lizard Man, but one is two words.
Air Force brat. Your dad, did he retire?
No, he was only Air Force for 7 or 8 years. He retired from TWA in 89.
And you spent a lot of time in California then?
Of course, not geocaching back then, but a lot of hiking and backpacking.
What part of California?
Westlake Village, just across the hills from the Malibu fires today.
You always had an interest in the outdoors.
Yeah, definitely. I got a GPS fairly early on before geocaching and was playing around with it for a while. I think I first heard about it from a friend of mine in California that I used to backpack from. He's also a geocacher, GPS Dave. Looked on the website sometime around February 2001, gave it a try.
And you were still out in California then?
No, that was out here. High school in California, college out here at Parks and just across the river to learn how to fly.
Your dad's experience in the Air Force and then in commercial airlines got you interested in that somehow.
Yeah, I always saw how much he enjoyed it. I thought that'd be a good way to earn a living.
You looked at that real early as a career. You knew that.
Yeah,
that's
I think I always knew. I always knew that was what I wanted to do.
You were in California, but you're living in Belleville, Illinois now?
Yes. Yeah, we've been there about 10 years now. Parker, Colorado for, I think, about 12 years before that.
And what took you there?
That was United Airlines. I was based in Denver. We decided to live where I was based.
Through all the turmoil of the airlines, United has pretty much been United all this time.
It's been a roller coaster for sure. It's still United, at least for a little while longer. There's a lot of merger talk.
What are your thoughts on things like Virgin Air, who is now establishing a few routes in between the big cities in the United States? Is that a good thing?
Well, maybe for consumers. It's tough on the other airlines, obviously, because they're given a lot of breaks to come into the industry. And it'll drive prices down, I'm sure. That's how you get into the new market, is you come in with some pretty low fares, and eventually they'll go back up again, but not till all the airlines bleed.
Your interest in flying planes, you obviously had to start out slow. Did your dad take you up and kind of teach you the rope?
He really didn't fly anything other than the big jets I learned in college. The airlines had really good simulators. Colleges generally had pretty crude type things. It was pretty much all in the airplane.
A joystick and a foot pedal.
It was kind of a joke. The simulators that the school had, there was no visual. It was basically just kind of a box that moved around, and you could navigate, and it had a plotter outside the box that would show whether you flew the right route.
And this was specifically a school to learn how to fly airplanes.
Yeah, it's been around since the 20s. It's actually part of St. Louis University.
They fly out of Lambert, or?
It's out of Bi-State, across the river there. And the campus used to be over there, but now it's over on the SLU campus.
Do you start out with small planes, like prop planes, and then
yeah,
work your way up to commercial? Or?
The first thing you do is you get your private license, which generally you learn in a two-seat Cessna or Piper. I learned in a Cessna 150, and I mean, like the John F. Kennedy Jr. crash, they try to teach you some how to at least keep yourself right side up on instruments, so you don't get in that kind of trouble.
That's the idea of where if you don't see the horizon, you still have to have some perspective of where you are in the sky.
After your private license, usually, then you start working on the instrument rating. They teach you how to navigate in the clouds without being able to see anything and find your way from one airport to another and down to a runway with lousy weather. Basically, once you finish college, you've got your degree and you've got a commercial license, which doesn't allow you to do a heck of a lot. Except for some, you know, basics that you can carry people for hire, but not much.
But do you have
else.
To have your own airplane, or do you join on with somebody who has a fleet of aircraft?
Yeah, that's the next tough part, is finding a job. I also went through and got my flight instructor certificate there. And with that, you're able to usually get a job teaching. And when you teach someone how to fly, you're also logging those hours. A lot of getting hired is based on experience, and you've got a logbook, and it shows how many hours you've flown and what you've flown, and they look at that. You know, flight instructing, you're able to get a lot of hours without having to pay for them yourself. And then usually people go on to fly charter.
Is that like commuters between St. Louis and Chicago?
Well, that's even before commuters. Back then, there really were very few commuters. They weren't really attached to the major airlines at all then. You had to instruct for a while, build some time, then you could get hired by a commuter. And of course, you're usually there just so you could build time so you get hired.
Leader of the Pack was put out there by Didge Guy to celebrate 5,000 cash. He and I went out there like a day or so before and found a spot to put it.
Yeah, I used to try to make sure I'd done all the caches within 25 miles or something. No, I don't even care.
It is 5:15 in Eureka, and I've got Jeff Tynan, who is known to a lot of people in the St. Louis area as Denali. First, Jeff, go on the Wayback Machine to day zero.
Back to day zero. Military family, Lincoln, Nebraska. My dad was with SAC, flying B-52s. We moved around with the military for quite a bit till my dad started with the airlines, flying for TWA back in 64. Probably my formative years out in Southern California from age 9.
You grew up on a military base?
Just through age 5. And then airlines after that, so we're civilians again.
You have brothers and sisters?
One brother, 2 sisters. Brother's also a geocacher, known as Lizard Man. He hasn't done much in a while. And there's actually 2 Lizard Men out there, and I think my brother's the one that's one word. They're both Lizard Man, but one is 2 words.
Air Force brat. Your dad, did he retire?
No, he was only Air Force for 7 or 8 years. He retired from TWA in 89.
And you spent a lot of time in California then?
Of course, not geocaching back then, but a lot of hiking and backpacking.
What part of California?
Westlake Village, just across the hills from the Malibu fires today.
You always had an interest in the outdoors.
Yeah, definitely. I got a GPS fairly early on before geocaching and was playing around with it for a while. I think I first heard about it from a friend of mine in California that I used to backpack from. He's also a geocacher, GPS Dave. Looked on the website sometime around February 2001, gave it a try.
And you were still out in California then?
No, that was out here. High school in California, college out here at Parks and just across the river to learn how to fly.
Your dad's experience in the Air Force and then in commercial airlines got you interested in that somehow?
Yeah, I always saw how much he enjoyed it. I thought that'd be a good way to earn a living.
You looked at that real early as a career. You knew that.
Yeah, I always knew. I always knew that was what I wanted to do.
You were in California, but you're living in Belleville, Illinois now?
Yes. Yeah, we've been there about 10 years now. Parker, Colorado for, I think, about 12 years before that.
And what took you there?
That was United Airlines. I was based in Denver. We decided to live where I was based.
Through all the turmoil of the airlines, United has pretty much been United all this time.
It's been a roller coaster for sure. It's still United, at least for a little while longer. There's a lot of merger talk.
What are your thoughts on things like Virgin Air, who is now establishing a few routes between the big cities in the United States? Is that a good thing?
Well, maybe for consumers. It's tough on the other airlines, obviously, because they're given a lot of breaks to come into the industry. And it'll drive prices down, I'm sure. That's how you get into the new market, is you come in with some pretty low fares, and eventually they'll go back up again, but not till all the airlines bleed.
Your interest in flying planes, you actually had to start out slow. Did your dad take you up and kind of teach you the ropes?
He really didn't fly anything other than the big jets I learned in college. The airlines had really good simulators. Colleges generally had pretty crude type things. It was pretty much all in the airplane.
A joystick and a foot pedal.
It was kind of a joke. The simulators that the school had, there was no visual. It was basically just kind of a box that moved around, and you could navigate, and it had a plotter outside the box that would show whether you flew the right route.
And this was specifically a school to learn how to fly airplanes.
Yeah, it's been around since the 20s. It's actually part of St. Louis University.
They fly out of Lambert, or?
It's out of Bi-State, across the river there. And the campus used to be over there, but now it's over on the SLU campus.
Do you start out with small planes, like prop planes, and then work your way up to commercial? Or?
The first thing you do is you get your private license, which generally you learn in a 2-seat Cessna or Piper. I learned in a Cessna 150, and I mean, like the John F. Kennedy Jr. crash, they try to teach you some how to at least keep yourself right side up on instruments. So you don't get in that kind of trouble.
That's the idea of where if you don't see the horizon, you still have to have some perspective of where you are in the
sky. after your private license, usually then you start working on the instrument rating. They teach you how to navigate in the clouds without being able to see anything and find your way from one airport to another and down to a runway with lousy weather. Basically, once you finish college, you've got your degree and you've got a commercial license, which doesn't allow you to do a heck of a lot, except for some, you know, basics. You can carry people for hire, but not much
else. But do
you have
to have your own airplane, or do you join on with somebody who has a fleet of aircraft?
Yeah, that's the next tough part, is finding a job. I also went through and got my flight instructor certificate there. And with that, you're able to usually get a job teaching. And when you teach someone how to fly, you're also logging those hours. A lot of getting hired is based on experience, and you've got a logbook, and it shows how many hours you've flown and what you've flown, and they look at that. You know, flight instructing, you're able to get a lot of hours without having to pay for them yourself. And then usually people go on to fly charter.
Is that like commuters between St. Louis and Chicago?
Well, that's even before commuters. Back then, there really were very few commuters. They weren't really attached to the major airlines at all then. You had to instruct for a while, build some time, then you could get hired by a commuter. And of course, you're usually there just so you could build time so you get hired by a major.
That's the goal of everybody, because
right.
That's the golden job.
It used to be. It's not quite so much. It's still a great job. If you love to fly, you know, I wouldn't rather do anything else. The view out your office window changes every trip. It's always something new, and there's always new problems to solve. And
what were the planes that people really wanted to fly when they were pilots when you first got into that? We had the chance to be able to choose, like, I would like to fly the Boeing, whatever.
That's pretty much dictated by seniority, based on when you were hired. I got hired in January 85. They tell you what you're going to fly when you start out. So I got to start out on the 727 as a plumber. That's what we call a flight engineer. So he's the guy back on the panel that handles the fuel balancing and the electricity and all that stuff.
Is he in the cockpit with everyone else?
Right.
So he knows what's going on and close communication.
Yeah, you'll have the captain and the first officer facing forward, and then the flight engineer is kind of sitting sideways there.
They call the first officer, do you used to be called the co-pilot?
Co-pilot or first officer. First officer is the official name. But
and over time, you work your way up in seniority, 747, 757.
Yeah, not necessarily that order, but generally the bigger airplanes, the pay is better.
But the longer flights,
right.
Because they are carrying more passengers with more fuel.
Flying the 747, you're maybe doing 6-day trips to Asia. And then you get home and spend 2 days trying to recover. So those can be tough. A lot of people just don't want to do that kind of flying. I fly the 767 and the 757 because they're pretty similar. Mostly fly the 767 over to Europe from Chicago, either to Amsterdam, Munich, or Paris. Those trips aren't too tough jet lag-wise. It's only a 3-day trip. You're there. You basically sleep, eat, work out, and come home.
It's not really a vacation. Like, oh, once I'm here, I'll spend a couple days and look around.
You fly all night. You get in at 9 in the morning, which is 2 in the morning here. Get to the hotel about an hour later, and I usually sleep for 4 or 5 hours. And then I'm up for maybe 7 hours, and then go back to bed again.
Is it the same crew that comes back that went there?
Yes. Every trip could be a different crew, although what trips you fly is also seniority-based. There's a bunch of us on the 767 that usually fly these trips. I see a lot of the same co-pilots. We have 2 co-pilots going over there because it's such a long flight. 2 guys that I've flown with before at some point.
Do you put it on autopilot after a while? I mean,
at some point,
it's the same path, can all be automated. You're just keeping an eye on the controls. If you have to take over, you can.
Enjoy the boon, enjoy the Northern Light. You have a sequence of tasks that have to be performed along the way, especially going out over the water. We've got systems to check, and after they're checked, we cross them off the list. Things we have to make sure is working before we head out over the ocean. And there's different controllers you're talking to along the way until you get out there over the Atlantic where there's no radar. They've got radio operators that can contact us if air traffic control needs us to change altitudes or something. Okay. Generally, it's set up so that the airplanes are following each other about 15 minutes behind each other if they're at the same altitude. Unless someone's catching up to someone, generally we won't hear anything. We have a common frequency we can talk to each other, give updates on turbulence
and tell jokes.
Weather and stuff. And tell occasionally, yes.
Is it true things like cell phones, GPS receivers, do they interfere with navigation systems?
They can. You were in the back and turned on a GPS receiver, probably a 99% chance it's not going to do anything. But maybe if three or four or five or six other people have some sort of electronic device on, maybe the combination's going to do it. I've heard of interference happening from electronic devices where they shut it all off and everything suddenly was working. Generally, first 10 minutes, of course, that's a crucial time, last 10 minutes where we have to make sure all the radio aids are working properly. En route, it's not going to be as big a deal.
That ends part one of two of my conversation with Jeff Tynan, also known as Denali. Stay tuned for the next episode where we will complete our conversation.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.
By major.
That's the goal of everybody, because right. That's the golden job.
It used to be. It's not quite so much. It's still a great job. If you love to fly, you know, I wouldn't rather do anything else. The view out your office window changes every trip. It's always something new, and there's always new problems to solve. And
what were the planes that people really wanted to fly when they were pilots when you first got into that? We had the chance to be able to choose, like, I would like to fly the Boeing, whatever.
That's pretty much dictated by seniority, based on when you were hired. I got hired in January 85. They tell you what you're going to fly when you start out. So I got to start out on the 727 as a plumber. That's what we call a flight engineer. So he's the guy back on the panel that handles the fuel balancing and the electricity and all that stuff.
Is he in the cockpit with everyone else?
Right.
So he knows what's going on and close communication.
Yeah, you'll have the captain and the first officer facing forward, and then the flight engineer is kind of sitting sideways there.
They call the first officer, do you used to be called the co-pilot?
Co-pilot or first officer. First officer is really the official name. But
and over time, you work your way up in seniority, 747, 757.
Yeah, not necessarily that order, but generally the bigger airplanes, the pay is better.
But the longer flights,
right.
Because they are carrying more passengers with more fuel.
Flying the 747, you're maybe doing six-day trips to Asia. And then you get home and spend 2 days trying to recover. So those can be tough. A lot of people just don't want to do that kind of flying. I fly the 767 and the 757 because they're pretty similar. Mostly fly the 767 over to Europe from Chicago, either to Amsterdam, Munich, or Paris. Those trips aren't too tough jet lag-wise. It's only a three-day trip. You're there. You basically sleep, eat, work out, and come home.
It's not really a vacation. Like, oh, once I'm here, I'll spend a couple days and look around.
You fly all night. You get in at 9 in the morning, which is 2 in the morning here. Get to the hotel about an hour later, and I usually sleep for 4 or 5 hours. And then I'm up for maybe 7 hours, and then go back to bed again.
Is it the same crew that comes back that went there?
Yes. Every trip could be a different crew, although what trips you fly is also seniority-based. There's a bunch of us on the 767 that usually fly these trips. I see a lot of the same co-pilots. We have two co-pilots going over there because it's such a long flight. Two guys that I've flown with before at some point.
Do you put it on autopilot after a while? I mean,
at some point,
it's the same path, can all be automated. You're just keeping an eye on the controls. If you have to take over, you can.
Enjoy the boon, enjoy the Northern Light. You have a sequence of tasks that have to be performed along the way, especially going out over the water. We've got systems to check, and after they're checked, we cross them off the list. Things we have to make sure is working before we head out over the ocean. And there's different controllers you're talking to along the way until you get out there over the Atlantic where there's no radar. They've got radio operators that can contact us if air traffic control needs us to change altitudes or something. Okay. Generally, it's set up so that the airplanes are following each other about 15 minutes behind each other if they're at the same altitude. Unless someone's catching up to someone, generally we won't hear anything. We have a common frequency we can talk to each other, give updates on turbulence
right,
and
tell jokes.
Weather and stuff. And tell occasionally, yes.
Is it true things like cell phones and GPS receivers, do they interfere with navigation systems?
They can. You were in the back and turned on a GPS receiver, probably a 99% chance it's not going to do anything. But maybe if three or four or five or six other people have some sort of electronic device on, maybe the combination's going to do it. I've heard of interference happening from electronic devices where they shut it all off and everything suddenly was working. Generally, first 10 minutes, of course, that's a crucial time, last 10 minutes where we have to make sure all the radio aids are working properly. En route, it's not going to be as big a deal.
That ends part one of two of my conversation with Jeff Tynan, also known as Denali. Stay tuned for the next episode where we will complete our conversation.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.